Good morning. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. This is our third case set for our oral calendar. You may be seated, counsel. Thank you. This is case number, I'm sorry, today is Thursday, October 24th, 2024. This is case number A24-0516, PPB Holdings versus County of Carver. Counsel for appellant, you will have 15 minutes for your initial oral arguments, followed by 15 minutes by respondent, and then counsel for appellant, you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you so choose. We do have a timer to the side, to your right, both of you to the right. Please keep track of that time so you know how much is left for you for your oral arguments. My colleague, Judge Larson here, will be keeping an eye on it also from us because I cannot see it from my vantage point, nor can my other colleague, Judge Bradfold. So if you see her looking over, she's still listening and paying attention to your arguments. She's not being distracted by something else. So with that, counsel for appellant, please, you may approach the podium, state your name for the record and the party you are representing. You may begin.
Thank you, Your Honors. Good morning. Patrick Neaton, representing appellant PPB Holdings. And we are here on this appeal for the purpose of, as just Justice Simonet stated in the Lupient decision, preserving the value of the award. I'm sure the court's familiar with the numbers in this case, but it might be worthwhile to recite them. The county acquired a valuable portion of PPB's residential rental property in Chaska in November of 2013. And it acquired it under the statutory quick take procedure, which allows the county to make a unilateral determination of what the, quote, approved appraisal value is for the damages resulting from the partial taking. The county determined, based upon an appraisal that the county obtained, that the value of the damages was $122,000. Now, approximately 8 years later, when this case goes to trial, the jury determined that the value of the property in the before condition was $1,500,000. And that in the after condition, what was left value was only $714,000. Damages, therefore, were $786,000. So the quick take payment that was made, or deposit, if you will, was only 15.5% of the PPB's ultimate damages. That may be justifiable if the case had been pending for a year, maybe for 2 years, but this case was pending for 8 years. And it was during a time of significant appreciation in the type of property that was involved in this taking, the location of the property that was involved in this taking. And it is severely prejudicial to PPB for the county to be allowed to pay only the minimal statutory 4% per annum rate of return when PPB and its principal, Richard Dorsey, showed the court, the trial court, that the return on the investment during that 8+ year period, and I should say the return on the $786,000 or the $664,000 difference between the quick take payment and the jury award was actually 14.5%. So there's a difference of 10.5%. Now, at the trial court level, we submitted Mr. Dorsey's what turned out to be completely uncontradicted evidence regarding the two factors are inherent in any real estate investment. One is the income that is produced from rentals during the term. The other is the appreciation. Combining those two, the annual was 14.5%. The court held, in our opinion erroneously, that we had not overcome the statutory presumption under 54909 that 4% should constitute just compensation. The trial court, Your Honor, made what we feel are three errors. First, the trial court accepted the county's argument that real estate investments fluctuate significantly. And the term fluctuate is important because that was probably the main reason in Lupient for the Minnesota Supreme Court to reject the landowner's proffered assessment of increase. There they used a basis of the pension plan, and the increase in the pension plan did not show exactly what was in the pension plan, but the court relied upon the state's evidence saying that, well, stocks during this period fluctuated. And since they fluctuated, it is not a low risk investment. Very low risk.
Which is language from Lupien.
Exactly, Your Honor. Yes. And that was the holding in Lupien, principally based upon the fluctuation.
Well, actually, two aspects. One is there has to be a guarantee of safety of principal, and two, it has to be a very low risk investment.
Yes, Your Honor. And in this case, Judge Kane erred by accepting the county's evidence on fluctuation. And what the county did and Judge Kane cited were two factors of real estate. It relied upon the electronically traded real estate investments during the period of 2016 to 2022. That's the period the county used. I'm not sure why. And then also commercial real estate during that same period. The problem with that is the situation that my client is in was residential rental real estate.
Right, but counsel, I think part of the challenge you have here is a couple of things. One is you have the statutory presumption of 4%, and that 4% is set as a floor to protect parties so they get at least some type of interest back when the government fails to pay them right away, and they take time, as they did here, eight years, which certainly is a long period of time. So you get that 4% rate of interest, and their expert, Tom Kerber, highlighted the fact that other investments comparable to that, CDs, T-bonds, AAA, corporate bonds, those actually had a rate of return less than 4%. But the other issue we have here is a standard of review. So we review the district court's determination for an abuse of discretion, in addition to the fact that there's that statutory presumption that 4% is, in fact, the default. So you have to show that the testimony from Kerber that real estate was not a low-risk investment based on the information that they had provided, and that And I realize that you do rely on the affidavit of Richard Dorsey. But in that affidavit, it seems to rely on one data point, money that he would have taken during that time and invested, and how his rate of return on that one particular investment. How does that meet the standard outlined in Lupient of showing that there was a guarantee of safety of principal and a very low risk for a real estate investment, which fluctuates, as you rightly noted, is language in Lupient, versus other types of investments that the Supreme Court said are, in fact, very low risk investments that guarantee principal, such as corporate AAA bonds, CDs, those types of investments? How is real estate, which fluctuates based on the evidence that the county presented, how does that meet that standard?
The evidence that we produced, and by the way, Your Honor, there was no testimony, so I didn't have an opportunity to cross-examine Mr. Kerber. This was simply submitted on affidavits.
Right.
But and certainly if I had an opportunity to cross-examine Mr. Kerber, it would have been with regard to his selecting electronically traded real estate and commercial real estate and not focusing on what my client lost, which was residential rental. And that's our argument. That's the center of our argument, Your Honor. You look at this type of property. It has to be a fair and reasonable return to meet the constitutional requirement of just compensation.
So here's my question, counsel, because I maybe went down the rabbit hole on this a little bit, but the way I see your argument is that as a constitutional just compensation, and in my review of the cases, I was not able to find a case that relied on the type of evidence that you are putting forward here as what's required to show just compensation. In your review, were you able to find any cases that are similar to this that used, you know, my client is a real estate person, that's where they would have invested their money, and therefore, even though, you know, real estate can go up and down, that is the appropriate rate of return for evaluating just compensation from a constitutional perspective?
Yes, Your Honor. Kirby Forest Industries versus United States, which I've cited in my brief, that was a U.S. Supreme Court decision from 1984. And in that case, the court talked about, I'll quote, when there is a substantial delay between the date of valuation and the date the judgment is paid, during which time the value of land changes materially, then it sent the case back to the district court and said, on remand, the district court can easily adduce evidence pertaining to alternation in the value of petitioner's tract.
But isn't that the land that was part of the taking, not the properties that would have been purchased with the money had the government given that money up front? I mean, isn't that case different in terms of looking at the value of property or looking at the value of land?
No, Your Honor, it is not, because what it was, what they said in that case, take a look at the specific land. In this case, we can't look at the specific value because the building was torn down as a result of the taking, and they built a road through it. But we can look at similarly situated properties during the same time period of its 8+ years in the same real estate market. And that is the evidence that we presented. And that evidence was uncontradicted.
But for the purpose of what the appropriate interest rate is, not what was the value of the property. I mean, we're not here arguing about the value of the property that was taken. We're here arguing about how do you calculate the interest rate. And so I guess my question is, do you have any cases that have relied on the evidence that you're asking us to rely on here to determine the appropriate interest rate for just compensation?
The closest I have is the Kirby Forest
Okay.
case, in which they said, take a look at what happened as far as appreciation in that real estate market for that period of time. And that's exactly what we did. And again, we're talking about constitutional fairness, and nothing could be more fair than equating it to the specific property. And that's where Judge Kane went down the wrong road when she accepted the county's assessment based upon the electronically traded real estate that fluctuates and commercial real estate, two entirely different markets.
Don't you mean residential real estate?
Excuse me?
Don't you mean residential real estate?
The county talked about electronically traded real estate funds and commercial real estate. My client's property was residential rental real estate.
Right.
And that's
my point.
That's what our evidence focused on in the time period in the same market area, not on a national scale and not with non-comparable properties. I'm out of time.
And you only have 5 minutes for rebuttal as well.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for respondent, you will have 15 minutes for your oral argument. Please state your name for the record and the party you're representing, and you may proceed carefully.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Peter Michael, and I represent the respondent, Carver County. On the merits, the district court should be affirmed because she clearly did not abuse her discretion by relying on the very type of evidence the Supreme Court in Lupien directed her to rely on in determining that the statutory presumption was not overcome by the appellants. I hope
can I ask just at the beginning for you to respond to it? I think that the appellant's main sort of equities argument here is that this case took a particularly long time in comparison to other cases. And if this was not a government taking, the interest rate would have been something closer to 10% because of the 8 years that it took to get this completed, rather than the, I can't remember if the statute is 1 to 2 or what the 4% is tied to. Could you just respond to why 4% in this context, even when there's been a particularly long length of time, is appropriate? Since I do think that this is a particularly long litigation for this kind of case.
Certainly, Your Honor, and thank you for the opportunity to answer that very question. The 4% rate of interest is appropriate over that period of time because over that entire period of time, the statutory rate of interest is pegged to the market. It fluctuates as the market rate of interest fluctuates. And over that entire period of time, the market rate was that low. It's not unusual for a case to take several years. It's not, something that we love, obviously. But it's not like the 4% was picked in 2013 and we're stuck with that regardless of what else happens. The evidence that was in front of the court below surveyed interest rates, investments that courts should look at, according to our Supreme Court, according to the Federal Court of Claims, to determine what is the fair interest rate to use to essentially present value of the money, right? So that assuming they had gotten it at that point in time in 2013, how do we peg an interest rate to figure out what's fair? And all of those investments were performing 2, 3, 4%. Actually, I don't know if any of them hit 4%. I'd have to look at the affidavit again. Underperformed. And so that's why, regardless of how long the period of time is, because the interest rate is flexible to adjust as interest rates in the market adjust, there is no unfairness that's based on whether it's 1 year, 3 years, 5 years in between the date of taking and the final payment. And if I may also, to follow up on a question Your Honor asked, to which my friend, I don't say that as a congressman, I really mean friend, offered the Kirby case. The Kirby case doesn't help their position at all. In fact, it's fatal to their position. In Kirby, the line that he quoted was talking about the difference between the date of valuation and the date of judgment, Kirby is an entirely different kind of case. We have in Minnesota and in federal law, there's also two types of takings. There's a quick take, which is what we used here, and there's a slow take. Kirby was a slow take case, meaning that the government doesn't even decide to take the property until the end. They find out what just compensation has been awarded and decide, do we want to pay that and take it, or are we going to abandon it and pay their fees? And so what Kirby stands for is the proposition that it's well established in Minnesota as well. The date of value for just compensation must be the date of taking. And so when you take that language, date of value to date of judgment was the date of taking. Date of value, if you read the Kirby case, and I'm a little bit unfamiliar with this because no one uses slow take anymore. Because you have to do just compensation as of some date, they select a date of value. And they select, according to the Kirby case, the date that they started the action. And so they did everything as of that date. But that's just a proxy, because what Kirby decided was there was no taking until the judgment. And we need to do the value as of the date of judgment. What's fatal to the appellant's case in Kirby was a line that's in the case that's actually in a block quote in their brief. The Supreme Court said, this is 467 U.S. at 17, change in the market value of particular tracts of land over time bears only a tenuous relationship to the market rate of interest. Some parcels appreciate at rates far in excess of the interest rate, others decline in value. Real estate is not a very low risk investment that guarantees safety of principal. That's the test that our Supreme Court mandates that we follow. So there can be no argument that Judge Kane chose to accept evidence that followed the Supreme Court's model pathway to evaluate this very issue and rejected this outlier claim based on, as Judge Reyes said, one data point that is selected, of course, with the benefit of hindsight. And we talk about this in our brief, of course. But we have to use low-risk investments. You could pick, over that period of time, you could pick Amazon. Amazon did great. You're not going to tell me I lost by investing in stock. If you look back in time and you say this is how it performed, we're looking at low-risk investments. Projecting forward, is this a safe investment? Is there a guarantee return of principal? That's why we're looking at CDs, T-bills, AAA-rated corporate bonds, because there's a contracted rate of return and return of principal. And that's, you know, that's not my argument. That's the Supreme Court's direction. The other issue I would like to address, while on the merits, this is a simple case, and there are examples of this very type of case that this court has ruled on in non-precedential decisions, rejecting claims to increase the rate of interest above the statutory rate using anything other than the types of very low risk investments that the court required. The issue here is subject matter jurisdiction. And the issue here is filing a claim, a new claim for an element of just compensation 2 years after final judgment. I'd like to just pause for a moment on the prejudice to the public of not learning until after the appeal period has lapsed on the judgment that the impact, the effect of that judgment is exposure to another $500,000 claim. So we argued in our brief, you know, applying general principles of jurisdiction for a district court, there are no cases on this subject because no one's tried this before. There's never been a case where someone said, 2 years after judgment, we're going to let you know, by the way, the toll has been running this whole time and you owe us a lot more money. That's never happened before this case. So we're applying general rules. When the public gets a judgment after a jury verdict, the government, the public has a choice to decide whether to appeal or not. There are always, speaking broadly, two issues in deciding whether to appeal. One, are there any meritorious issues to raise to this court? And two, and hopefully the law students get this one, what are the stakes? It's not just, do I have a good claim of error in the trial court? Is the judgment against me $700,000 plus a couple hundred thousand dollars in interest, which I can calculate because I know that, and now my client knows the stakes. Do we swallow it and move on? Do we try and negotiate a settlement, or do we appeal? It's not fair for the public to not know that it's not $200,000 in interest until after we can't appeal that judgment anymore, but rather they're claiming it's $750,000. You know, we have under Rule 54 a deadline to bring a motion for costs and disbursements of 45 days. There's a couple of reasons for that, as I'm sure the court is aware. One of them is so that that issue is resolved, and if it's appealed, those appeals can be consolidated and you have judicial economy.
But when did appellant learn of what the actual, whether the 4% statutory presumptive interest rate was going to be applied?
They knew that from day one. It's actually quite insulting to suggest that our esteemed colleague, Mr. Gunn, didn't know that, or that they couldn't know that until we made our deposit. The statutory rate is mandated. We are required by statute on 117 to apply the 549.09 rate. We're required to do that. We
when
couldn't
was that,
do
when,
anything.
Right. But when was that deposit made then?
December of, so the judgment came in August of 2021, December 1st or 2nd of 2021. A couple of weeks after the appeal period expired, we made the deposit with interest calculated to that date.
So despite the judgment, why wouldn't they still be able to challenge the interest rate? Because they really don't know until they actually have the check deposited whether or not that is the rate that's going to be applied.
That's incorrect, Your Honor, because the rate must be the statutory rate unless they take the initiative to make a claim that it's something else. We have no choice. We must apply that rate unless and until they make a claim and a judge accepts that claim.
But the district court never said the interest rate shall be 4%.
That's correct.
So, I mean, there's no notice. There's no explicit notice by the district court.
From the district court. It's right in, it's embedded in the statutes. In 117, the statutes cited in the brief, but in 117,
right.
The interest rate must be applied. There's nothing for a judge to decide, right? The time period is established by statute, date of taking to date of payment. The rate is established by statute 549.09. Chapter 117 specifically says you must apply 549.09. The accrual of that interest is established in 549.09.
Right, right.
And this is a matter for the court administrator to simply apply.
I want to throw out a hypothetical.
Okay.
Let's assume for the sake of argument that, just like here, the district court never explicitly made any statement in terms of the interest rate, and final judgment is entered August, fall of 2021, and then appellant receives a check, and there's no interest rate on it.
And there's, I'm sorry,
no interest rate attached.
Okay.
Okay. Hypothetically, are you saying that the district court no longer has jurisdiction for appellant to challenge the lack of any interest being attached at that point?
So if the government failed to make the interest payment required by statute, there would simply be no satisfaction of judgment yet. And the interest would still be running on whatever is still left on a partially paid judgment. There's no need for judicial intervention. There's simply no satisfaction of judgment at that point.
But wouldn't appellant be in the position to be able to go back to the district court and say, district court, we want that for, they failed to pay us what is due to us. They failed to follow the statute and pay us 4% interest on that. Wouldn't the district court have jurisdiction to hear that matter?
No, Your Honor.
Why not?
So what would happen in this case and in any other kind of case, judgments are entered and they accrue interest at the statutory rate. And if defendant or judgment debtor purports to pay that judgment and underpays it, that's a partial satisfaction of judgment. It's not a complete satisfaction of judgment. The liability for the unpaid amount remains. A writ of execution can be issued by the court administrator. You don't need the judge to get involved in this at all. This is all part of judgment remedies. There's no point where you stop back at the judge to say, wait a minute, I've been wronged. It's simply the clock is still running. The judgment's unpaid.
What if the court administrator says, too bad, so sad. The judgment's already been entered. Appellant, you can't challenge that. I'm troubled by the lack of ability of a party to get the just compensation to which they are entitled, because that comes after the judgment.
Your Honor, when the public pays is one issue. What rate the government must pay at is a separate issue. When we pay, there was nothing in the statute or in the law or in the judgment that required the County of Carver to deposit the payment of that judgment in December. If we left that judgment unpaid till this day, it would still be accruing interest and they could exercise judgment creditor remedies to go get that money. The time for when judgment is paid, the tick dictates how much interest is accrued. The rate at which it accrues. And by the way, both parties know that. Both parties know what the rate is. They know what the judgment is. They know how it's accruing over time to down to a per diem rate. What the rate of the judgment of interest is established by a statute unless there is a motion brought in front of the judge to say and adjudicate this as an element of just compensation, accepting evidence. Lupien said to use affidavits and depositions and make a decision. What should the rate be? That's all part of just compensation. And it's hard for me to understand how a district court could have jurisdiction to enter into that kind of further just compensation adjudication after final judgment and after the appeal period.
What's your best case law that you are relying on that there is no subject matter jurisdiction and that the party has to bring a motion before the judge prior to judgment being entered?
I can point to no case law in this specific circumstance, Your Honor, and neither can appellant point to any case law that authorizes a motion like this after the appeal has expired. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for respondent, or I'm sorry, counsel for appellant, you have 5 minutes for your rebuttal.
Thank you. Let me just first finish on the substantive issue of our ability to seek the 14.5% rate. I mentioned that I thought the court erred in three ways. We addressed the first, which was the fluctuation in real estate values, where the court addressed or relied on real estate investments that had no similarity whatsoever to the subject property. The other thing that the court did was accept the county's position that we can't do a backward-looking analysis. And that just isn't true. What the court said actually in Lupien was that a reasonable rate of return should be determined over the relevant period of time. Now, that relevant period of time in this case is 8+ years. And the only way that we can determine what a reasonable interest or return on investment rate is by looking back. And that is what we presented. We have presented what we feel is a very fair and reasonable assessment to determine just compensation. That is, if you hadn't taken this property, or if you paid us the full $786,000 when you did take it instead of 8+ years later, this is what we could have done. Not only could have done, this is what we would have done. The $122,000 that was paid was invested by PPB in another rental, residential rental property. Plus, they had to put some other money down. If they'd had the full 786, they would have been able to invest and enjoy the 9+% per annum rate of return that type of real estate saw in that specific geographical area.
But I think that's a different question of whether or not I understand your argument. I certainly understand your argument, 8-year period. And I don't think that's in dispute. But I think The challenge I have is whether or not residential real estate investments meet the standard under Lupient of a guarantee the principal and of a very low risk of investment. And Lupient's language refers to certificates of deposit, U.S. Treasury bills, government bonds, and AAA corporate bonds. I'm struggling with how residential real estate falls into the category of those what are widely considered very low risk, very safe investments. Residential real estate sounds like more like it falls into the category of stocks and bonds and investing in Amazon, as counsel for respondent said, which I wish he would have told me to do many years ago, but he failed to do. I won't hold that against you. But how does that fit into the category of those very low risk investments?
Well, first of all, the court used that footnote, and then it said, these are not exclusive. These are examples. And any other very low risk type investment can also be considered. Now, the third error the court made, I think, is equating very low risk investment and guarantee of principal with no risk. There are no risk investments. No matter what you invest in, no matter who provides a guarantee, there is always some risk. Now, our uncontradicted evidence was that during the applicable period of time, this 8-year plus time period, the appreciation in this type of real estate averaged over 9% per year, and the return from rental of that type of real estate, the net return averaged over 5%. So we come up with 14.5%. That's uncontradicted. Having an unleveraged real estate purchase, no mortgage, and you can insure real estate, residential real estate, there is very, very low risk. And that's why we submit, not only does it qualify under Lupient, but it is also the only fair and reasonable type of investment that guarantees or provides us with a constitutionally guaranteed just compensation. And I see I'm out of time. Thank you very much.
Thank you both, counsel. Thank you for your arguments, and thank you for your candor to the court as well. We always appreciate that. We will be issuing an opinion within the 90-day statutory timeframe. That is our last oral argument set for this calendar. So the court now is adjourned.